You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for the week ending June 13th. I'm Joe Elia. We offer a roundup of the week's news, along with an interview we hope you'll find of interest. This week's is about showing patients their risks in a novel way. If you'd like to leave us a comment, and we hope that you will, call 617-440-4374. Story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. On to the news roundup. A vaccine against avian influenza has been successfully tested, according to a report in the New England Journal of Medicine. The vaccine was tested in volunteers in Singapore and Austria. It effectively raised antibodies against both a primary strain of H5N1 used in the vaccine, as well as two other strains. The vaccine was grown in cell culture, which would be an advantage in an avian flu pandemic that would severely restrict the supply of hens' eggs, since most birds are at high risk for the disease. Patients with dementia show a modest benefit from exposure to brighter lighting and taking melatonin, according to a JAMA study. Dutch researchers installed brighter lights in the common rooms of some group care facilities and randomized patients to receive melatonin tablets or placebo. The lighting worked, but melatonin without the brighter lighting caused some behavioral problems. Writing in Journal Watch Psychiatry, Peter Royburn said that the combination showed a modest effect, quoting, comparable in size to what would be expected for a marketed medication. Children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder showed no benefit from using St. John's wort. Researchers report in JAMA that they used a double-blind, placebo-controlled design in about 50 children with ADHD. After 8 weeks therapy, there was no difference between active treatment and placebo in clinical improvement. The study was conducted at a College of Naturopathic Medicine. Writing in Journal Watch Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine, F. Bruder Stapleton comments, quoting, this type of solid evidence is needed to help frustrated families weigh the benefits of alternative therapies when standard approved treatments are unsatisfactory. Revised guidelines governing implantable devices for treating cardiac arrhythmias are available. They've been issued jointly by the American College of Cardiology, the American Heart Association, and the Heart Rhythm Society. Links to the guidelines are available at the Journal Watch website. Writing in Journal Watch Cardiology, Mark Link says that with regard to the cardiomyopathies, quoting, the revisions made have been primarily to the ejection fraction cutoffs for device implantation and in the combination of ejection fraction with clinical heart failure to define indications for device therapy. The Annals of Internal Medicine published a study looking at the experience of some 100,000 patients in ICUs across the country. The study finds that patients under the care of an intensivist had higher hospital mortality rates than those under the care of others, even after adjusting for illness severity. In Journal Watch Hospital Medicine, Aaron Calderon writes, quoting, the results of this study contradict previous findings and could bring into question our current models of provision of critical care in the U.S. Among this study's many limitations, the chief caveat is that unrecognized confounders likely contributed to these unexpected findings. Here is this week's roundtable. Earlier this week, the Journal of the National Cancer Institute published an update to charts first published in 2002 by Dr. Stephen Woolocean and colleagues. The charts detail in a straightforward way a person's risk of dying from common and commonly feared diseases. The person's risks are presented according to their age, their sex, and their smoking status. For instance, a 60-year-old woman who has never smoked will see that in a group of 1,000 other non-smoking women her age, 3 will die of lung cancer in the next 10 years. If the same woman was a smoker, she'd see that 41 fellow smokers will die, a big difference from the 3 non-smoker deaths. Dr. Woolocean and his co-authors encourage clinicians to post the tables where patients will have easy access to them. We've asked Dr. Woolocean to chat with us. He is a general internist and an associate professor at Dartmouth Medical School. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi.
I want to ask you how you got interested in making these charts. Was the point to reduce smoking in your patients?
No, actually, was a good side effect of the project. Excuse me. The original purpose of the charts was really in response to this perception that we had that people are bombarded by messages about the health risks that they face, and they're hearing about one disease this week, one disease that week, and in ways that make it hard to compare. And I think the result is it leaves people confused. They don't know what to be worried about or where to put their efforts into reducing their risks. So we thought it would be helpful to put together a table that would help people make sense of the major, health risks that they face.
I see. And what were your patients' reactions when they saw things like 41 deaths versus 3 deaths in say, smoking?
Well, not only the patients, but other researchers, often one of the first things that they'll say when they look at the charts is they'll remark about the how powerfully it shows the dangers of smoking. So people immediately zero in on that and pick up on it. And I think the charts really hammer home the point that smoking is really adds to your risk. In the charts show that the effect of smoking is about the same as adding about 10 years of age to your life in terms of your risk of dying from all causes if you're a man, and between 5 and 10 years if you're a woman.
I see. And these charts were first published in 2002, and these are revisions of those charts. And why did you decide to revise them?
For a few reasons. One, more recent data became available. The original set of charts were published in 2002, but they were based on the most recent national death data available at the time, which was 1998. And since then, there's now death data available from 2004. And then the other reason is that we've been able to improve the algorithm we use to do the calculations. with the first charts, we got some very helpful feedback, sort of like the best kind of peer review from other researchers who had some questions about how we handled former smokers. The charts we published just were for never smokers and current smokers, and we had to do some account for former smokers in a variety of ways. The new charts, we have, a much better algorithm, and we now have charts for never smokers, current smokers, and former smokers.
I see. And those the results for the former smokers seem to be about intermediate between between current smoking and non-smoking. Is that?
That's right. For things that are related to smoking. So there's some causes of death that have no relationship to smoking, and there's no difference across the groups. But for things like for lung cancer, for example, right, there's a dramatic gradient across the levels of smoking.
As I was looking at the tables, I noticed that there are certain things. For instance, smoking caught my attention because of the big jump there between smokers and non-smokers. But among many diseases, for instance, cervical cancer, prostate cancer, the number of people dying from those diseases is relatively small when you compare them, say, with heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was looking at an article this weekend about finasteride and whether people should be taking that to avoid prostate cancer, I couldn't help but think that there's one person in 1,000 who's going to die of the disease, and that's a lot of drugs to be taking as a preventive for something with a rather small risk.
Right. Although it's important to point out, the one person of 1,000 when you're at a younger age is as you get older, the risk of dying from prostate cancer increases and starts to increase dramatically once you're in your later 70s. But the whole point of the charts is for people like you to decide whether the risks seem big or small, because then you can decide whether it's worth doing things like consider finasteride or lower your cholesterol or whatever intervention you might have. But without quantifying the risk that you face, it's very hard to decide whether it's worth worrying about or it's worth taking an action. And that's the whole purpose of the chart.
I see. In the research paper that accompanies the charts, you give some examples of how the federal agencies like the Food and Drug Administration depict risk in ways that are not easy for people to understand. For instance, you use the 3,700 deaths per year attributed to cervical cancer. If you could advise them on how to present those risks in a clearer way, how would you do that?
there's a number of things that I would suggest. And, I mean, when I'm all done, it's going to sound like I'm suggesting the chart, so I'll just warn you in advance.
Yeah, all right.
But when you just give a number, like 3,700 people will die in a year of some disease, that's a common technique. It's a good sort of marketing technique to grab people's attention because, you know, 3,700 deaths sounds like a big number, and it grabs people's attention. The problem is if you don't have the denominator, the 3,700 out of how many people, then I think you're not really giving the full story. So 3,700 deaths of cervical cancer divided by, let's say, 150 million women, now all of a sudden you can see where the scale fits. The other problem is when you give just a count like that by itself, it makes it hard to compare. Like, so there's 3,700 women who die of cervical cancer, but how about other things? You know, where does this fit into the whole sort of menu of risk that women face? So I think it's really important to also provide some context. And then the other thing that's important is to account for age. A woman's chance of dying from cervical cancer, like many, probably most diseases, increases with age. If you just give this one blanket number, it's hard to see, you know, how does that compare if I'm young, how does it compare if I'm old. And then finally, that particular message just says in the next year. But when people are thinking about risks that they face, they're usually thinking about longer blocks of time, and risk accumulates over time. So I think it's much more valuable to tell someone, you know, at a given age, the chance that you're going to die from this disease over the next 10 years is, you know, X. And the reason we use 10 years, there's nothing really magical about 10 years, but it's enough time that people can imagine. It's enough time where you could do something about your risk. And it's also enough time to let risk accumulate so you don't artificially make risk seem small. Because in general, if you use a short time frame, even big risks will sound small.
I also heard that you've got a book coming out about this very topic. And can you tell us anything about it?
Sure. You know, the risk charts try to provide people with the magnitude of the risks that they face. But that's only one bit of the whole puzzle of helping people understand risk. The other part of there's many other things that people need to be able to do. They need to know when information is missing. They need to know what kinds of questions to ask to fill in gaps. They need to know how to compare risks. And what we've done is we've written a book. It's actually a primer to help prepare people to be on the receiving end of health messages. So when they see things, you know, in drug advertisements or public service announcements or newspaper articles, they can sort of approach these messages and understand really where when things are being exaggerated, where things are being where information is missing, and sort of figure out what's the real critical information they can hang their hat on. The book is called Know Your Chances, Understanding Health Statistics. It's going to be published by University of California Press, and it's supposed to come out in October. And the risk charts play a prominent role in the book. The book, half of the book basically, is teaching people how to read the charts and how to use the information, the kind of information that the charts provide. The other half of the book is about how to understand benefit. So you, now that you know the risks that you face, there's a whole set of skills that you need in order to approach messages about how to reduce your risk. So I think we tried really hard to provide information that we think consumers need to make sense of health messages and understand what information is fair, what information is complete, and what information is exaggerated.
That sounds interesting. So it's called Know Your Chances.
Yes.
Okay. I know that in the research paper you give the algorithm for calculating, and it's not something that somebody without a calculator at hand could do readily, but how to calculate the risks for various diseases, and you put that out in the public so that people can repeat those calculations for,
yes,
for other diseases that aren't in the tables.
Yes.
Are you aware of anyone doing that yet?
Yes. Actually, the new set of charts, of course, are just published this week, but a couple of years ago, a researcher from Germany wanted to do similar calculations for a German audience, and we know a pediatrician asked us to do some calculations for some diseases that are really specific to a pediatric population. But as you mentioned, in our article, we lay out the steps that you need in order to do these calculations in what we think is a very transparent way. So anybody should be able to not only reproduce them, but also to extend them. So if there's a particular disease that you're interested in, If you follow the steps in the article, you should be able to create a new column for a risk chart.
All right. Well, Dr. Will Ocean, thanks so much for your time with us today.
Sure. Thank you.
Finally, from the Department of No Surprise Here, comes word that Pennsylvania, having rescinded its motorcycle helmet law, has seen a 30% increase in severe head injuries. Promise you'll wear yours, okay? Thanks for listening. We'd like to listen to you. Call us at 617-440-4374 and give us your thoughts, which we'll use here after we verify it's really you who's talking. To that end, leave your name and your phone number at the start of your message. This is Joe Elia. We'll see you next time.